Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. It's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, we hear so much about the global refugee crisis, it's almost become something like white noise. But we're going to cut through that with a riveting conversation about the realities and extreme challenges being faced by these displaced and often desperate individuals, families, and children, with one of the premier human services agencies engaged with these folks, Connecticut's Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services. And we'll invite you out to Run for the Refugees on February 3rd. Then we're going to head out to Simsbury to learn about an ongoing project being handled primarily by high school students and supporters at the Simsbury Free Library, which is promoting the little-known details of the two summers that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. spent here in Connecticut and the important career-defining decisions he made as a temporary resident of our Nutmeg State. And we're going to close checking in with a representative of the Parent Leadership Training Institute. This year's PLTI programs have just begun, but unfortunately, they're few and far between due to extremely limited funding. So we wanted to share some details about this important program in the hopes that listeners will advocate for the full restoration of this leadership and community building program for parents, grandparents, caregivers, and anyone who cares about our children and the future leaders across Connecticut. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. Attention anyone who owns or is involved in operating a business. Connecticut Secretary of the State and Attorney General are warning businesses across Connecticut about a mailing being sent by the Workplace Compliance Services purporting to be an official annual report instruction form alleging that payment is required by Connecticut law. This deceptive solicitation has an official appearance and references a Connecticut state law, but the scam directs the recipient business to send an inflated fee for filing an annual report that can be filed directly with the state at cd.gov/annual report. If your business has received the bogus annual report instruction form, please make a complaint with the Office of the Attorney General at attorney.general@ct.gov and include a copy of the mailing as an investigation into it, and coordination with the U.S. Postal Inspector is underway. Well, as we open up the program this morning, it should be said that we're taping this program a couple of days before it aired. We're here about noontime on Friday before our Sunday broadcast. So we don't exactly know as things change in Washington, here in our country and globally every few seconds, it seems. We're not sure about what's going to be going on at the border, the southern border of the United States. But obviously, individuals who are refugees are on our minds in the media, seemingly in a 24-hour cycle, and we are so pleased to be revisiting with our friends from IRIS, the Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services, based right here in Connecticut. Our new friend Ann O'Brien is with us. She's Director of Community Engagement, and you know, we only got to know IRIS a couple of years ago. We were really late to the game. This organization's been around since 1982, and over the past 3.5 decades, their goal, however, has remained constant. They want to provide a haven to refugees and other immigrants, and they are helping refugees from all over the world. So we're going to talk about the refugee crisis as we see it here in the early days of 2019. Ann, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John. It's an honor to be here, and it's really nice to have folks really trying to delve deeper and understand what's going on with immigrants in our state and in our nation.
Yeah, I think that's really the most important thing, because like stigmas with issues related to individuals who are maybe coming out of incarceration, or stigmas against individuals on the autism spectrum or with developmental disabilities or physical disabilities, the more you try to kind of gently talk about the subject without kind of pushing it on people or advocating or waving a flag, so to speak. I think the easier it is for people to begin to start to understand the other side of the story. So speaking of that, let's talk a little about the refugee crisis. Some might say we almost hear about it so much it's becoming white noise. We're not necessarily really paying attention to it anymore, but you are.
Yes, we definitely are. We're paying attention to it in terms of what most folks have watched in the news the past couple of weeks and months in terms of the issues down at the southern border. But also it's important for the American public to understand that even though our attention as a nation has focused a lot and more internally, the world as a whole is still undergoing the same refugee crisis that existed 2-3 years ago. It's still the largest number of displaced people and refugees since World War II. That has not let up from the worldview. And that is something that we are very aware of here at IRIS. And we're aware of that not just in terms of the refugees that we're receiving from overseas in terms of the numbers. We're one of the few agencies that has continued to receive refugees. We just welcomed 4 new families on Tuesday from Afghanistan. But we're also aware of it in terms of, you know, the types of refugees that we're receiving. Not only are we still receiving refugees from the Congo, which is the world's longest running conflict, but also from wars that we have been engaged in and are still engaged in. The folks that have come to us, the families that have come to us most recently from Afghanistan are not only refugees still coming from that conflict, but also people that have worked for our own U.S. military in those conflicts and had hoped to rebuild and stay in their own home country, but couldn't because of the work that they had done with our military, and their lives became threatened even 8 and 10 years later. And so we need to continue to raise our heads up and look at what's going on in the world, even though it may at some times become somewhat overwhelming, and to realize that these are families just like us that have hopes and goals, but more importantly, have a need to be safe. Yeah. In the current terms.
Well, you introduce a really, really interesting point that no matter what your worldview is, I hope that one could relate to, and that is you have thousands and thousands of individuals, Americans came to their country in conflict to support, to fight, whatever. They were at great risk, and that risk was lessened due to the liaison relationships that they made with these thousands of native folks in their countries. These folks put themselves and their families, extended families, to great risk by helping Americans as liaisons and assistants, translators, so to speak, in wartime. Then the Americans presumably came home to their country, and these individuals were, for whatever reason, then put continuing to be at risk, and then they want to come somewhere safe, and
exactly.
The U.S. is the place. I mean, maybe one of the only relationships that they've ever had with somebody outside of their country has been with soldiers or American government operators from the U.S.
Exactly, John. Exactly. You know, these folks, I've spoken with so many of them. There's one in particular that comes to mind who he's a young father in his early 30s. He has a daughter and 2 sons. And when I asked him why he first started working for the U.S. military, he has a master's degree from Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And I said, why did you start working for the U.S. military? And he said, it was obvious that they were the good guys. They were trying to help us rebuild. He said, but the most obvious thing to me that made me think that I really had to do it is under the previous government and under the Taliban, my sisters couldn't go to school. And he said, I looked at my daughter, and I wanted her to be able to go to school. And so he did. He stepped out of his training and took on running these things called a radio in a box program, where he would hire Islamic scholars and female Afghan DJs to run these radio programs to get a true message about what the U.S. military was trying to accomplish out to the uneducated that lived out in the remote areas. Basically, a message that would present cognitive dissonance, a different message to what was being put out there by the Taliban. That is an unbelievable risk on his part. And because of it, some of his folks that he had hired were killed as a message to him. So after doing that for 6 years, 6 years he did that, moving his family twice within the country. Finally, it reached a point where the military that he reported to within the U.S. said, we have to get you out of the country.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, those folks have gone to unbelievable extent in terms of their risk for a country that they had never seen until that point, right, until they came here to the U.S.
Yeah.
But that, you know, answers the question a lot of people have for us. You know, when they get here, what do they do? What do these refugees do? Well, 13% of refugees are entrepreneurs. That's compared to 9% for the U.S.-born population. These people are motivated when they get here. They sense the safety. They sense the values that are our core values of pulling your feet up, you know, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. And that works for them because, you know what, that's how they survived in a conflict zone and kept their family together.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, those are the types of families that we're looking at in terms of resettling right now.
Yeah. One of the other groups that we have great concern for and that also seem to be in great focus, it seems more so over the past 3 to 5 years and certainly in the past couple, are the children of conflict. And this is a particular group that you're seeing a continuous and disturbingly disproportionate number of.
Yes, absolutely. So over the years, our numbers have remained the same. In that, whether it's refugees from Afghanistan, from the Congo, as well as folks that have come to us from Central and South America, that, you know, always the proportion is more than half are children. So more than half of those that we resettle, close to 60%, are under the age of 18. And those, when people say, gosh, you know, refugees, do we have to protect them all? Well, more than half are children. Of course we do. We have a responsibility to the children of our world to make sure that they're not growing up in conflict zone and without. Many of the children that we work with come to us and have been out of school for 6 to 8 years. When you're living as a refugee in a neighboring country, you're often not allowed to go to school. Your parents are definitely not allowed to work. So when they get here, our main job is to not just get them into school, but to get them volunteer tutors that will work with them after school so that they can get caught up on the 3 to 4 or more years of school that they have missed once they get here.
Well, in the folks, if you're just tuning in, thanks for joining us on the award-winning For the People this morning. Anne O'Brien is with us. She's Director of Community Engagement for IRIS, the Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services here in Connecticut. We've got about 5 more minutes with Anne and having a very stimulating conversation about refugees and the refugee crisis. And Anne, as you heard, we only have a little bit of time. We would not spend a segment, but probably the entire hour of the program talking deeply about issues related to refugees and some of the misconceptions about who is coming across our southern borders. But in the elevator conversation in a minute or two, what is the most important thing from your perspective that you'd like to communicate to the listeners about the situation at the southern border and perhaps a misconception that is tied or inherent with some of the rhetoric out there?
So that is a great question, John. I think the most important thing for people to do is to push themselves just a little bit, to look beyond the words of caravan or look beyond the words of migrant. Who are these people? Who are these families? Case in point, there are two families that we've been helping that were separated from their children this past June at the border and were reconnected, reunited up here in Connecticut. And we have been helping those two families. You know, one is a mother and her 14-year-old daughter from Honduras. So they walked. They literally walked from Honduras because of the attacks that had been visited upon their family by the gangs down there. Now, one can sit there and say, is gang like war? Well, when they've taken your oldest son and they're coming back to say your husband has to join as well, I don't know how that is different from conscription into a military that has taken over a country. There's no difference in those two scenarios in terms of a family level. And people really need to try to put themselves at that level, because in what other situation would a mother leave with her 14-year-old daughter and walk the distance of two United States in order to have a chance at safety? So, you know, that's a perfect example of what where we have to push ourselves. I know it's hard. We want to quickly scan the news and just get the tidbits. When you do that, then you are literally ignoring the reality of there being families. These are people that are no different from us. And that's what we have to push ourselves to think about. Yeah. You know, what would make you leave your home and walk 2,000 miles with no guarantee of security on the other side? You would only do that if what you were leaving was too dangerous to let your children and yourself stay in. That's no different than any other type of quote-unquote war. We're just calling it something different.
And I understand the rhetoric, the some of the long-term issues and statements that are being made, and some of the distrust is actually resulting in a spike in the number of refugees who are self-presenting to your agency for assistance versus being referred through NGOs or government services?
Yeah, it's an interesting shift that we've seen over the past couple of years, that we do have a larger number and a broader range of countries represented of immigrants that have approached us for help. And, you know, when we say help, it means, for instance, they have been working two or three jobs and they have been here for a couple of years and their English has gotten better and they want help finding that next level of job so that they have a chance of, you know, getting out of being the working poor, or their child is having challenges in school and they want help talking to the school. And they have heard that we are immigrant friendly. And, you know, we always question, it's kind of like, you know, wow, these numbers have gone up. We're honored that they trust us to come and to ask for help. But our question is always also, you know, what were they doing before? Is there a reason why they're not, you know, asking for help from government organizations that are put there to help them find jobs and otherwise? And so, you know, we see a difference also in our food pantry. We run a weekly food pantry for those that have food insecurity. And we've seen an uptick in that as well in terms of attendance. And so to us, what we're seeing that as and what we're hearing from people is that they feel comfortable with our organization because we are focused on working with immigrants. They're afraid to ask for help that they're entitled to other organizations or other people. So that's something that we all really need to think about as far as the impact of the rhetoric that is not going to be reported upon because people are afraid to even ask for help that is not a handout. It's literally guidance or an introduction or guidance on how to go about getting a certification. They just don't know who to trust anymore.
Very good. Well, in the last couple of moments that we have with you, Anne O'Brien, we want to call people to one of the most popular and best attended races of the winter season, and that's coming up on Sunday, the 3rd of February. It's the Run for Refugees. Let folks know how they can participate in that with proceeds going back to underwriting the services and initiatives at IRIS, the Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services.
So the easiest way to do that is to go to our website, to irisct.org. So it's irisct.org. Mm-hmm. Or they can also find us by going to Run for Refugees, all run together, runforrefugees.org. Both ways will get them to register. The most important thing about this event is, you know, it's a race if you want to be an elite runner. It's also an amazing walk with community of supporters that welcome immigrants, that welcome refugees. So we have a huge number of walkers, families pushing babies in strollers. Mm. And then we have an amazing international food festival afterward. We're going to have chefs from the Sudan cooking, chefs from Syria, chefs from Afghanistan, from the Congo, and donated food from an incredible range of restaurants, over 20 restaurants in the greater New Haven area. But the best part is just the community feel for this event. We've grown to over 3,000 people, but it's so funny, that might sound like an overwhelming number, and it's not when you're here, because everybody is so friendly. Mm-hmm. Everybody just wants to be here and to run and walk and welcome refugees. And refugees get to participate for free. So they're here, and everybody loves that they can just be with them in a big community celebration.
Very good. Folks, if you're interested, once again, in participating, learning more about what IRIS does, or perhaps getting involved in some other way, volunteering, underwriting, just getting to know their mission and being able to communicate that when you're out with your coworkers, your friends on the sidelines of the soccer field, what have you, just go to their website, irisct.org, for the Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services. Their Director of Community Engagement is Anne O'Brien. She's been our guest for our first segment this morning. Anne, thank you so much. Best of luck with the run. And do reach out if we can be of any service to you folks going forward. Thank you so much for being part of the program. Well, the question that we posed at the beginning of this segment this morning is, did the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. ever live in Connecticut? Well, a group of students in Simsbury set out to prove that popular myth and discovered not only did he spend time in our state, his experience actually shaped his personal philosophies. The students are in the process of building a permanent Martin Luther King Memorial on the grounds of the Simsbury Free Library, where we are today. And we're visiting with one of those students, as well as Tara Willerup, the vice chairman of the Simsbury Free Library's Board of Trustees. And the student we'll be speaking with very shortly is Brekina Grychewski. So first, let's pick it up with Tara. Tara, this is a beautiful building. Thanks for having us here. You're on the Board of Trustees, and you also do some administrative work at the library. Just tell us more about it.
So glad to have you here. Yeah. Everyone is always welcome. We are a small library. We were originated in 1874 by Amos Eno as a free library in town where people could borrow and exchange books. In the 1980s, the town grew to a point where the town took over the use of the public library, and that is two doors down from us here, and we remain as a genealogical historic research library. We are a community center, and we like to consider ourselves a reading room if people want to come in, but we try to be open to the community.
And you also have some other, do I see from the placard out front, there's some other entities that share the building?
Correct. We have our downstairs, we have the Chamber of Commerce and the Simsbury Visitor Center. And upstairs, we have the Farmington River Watershed as our tenants.
Okay, sure.
So we share with a lot of nonprofits.
Too. And so does this, this does not serve as the Historical Society, however?
No. The Historical Society is down the street, again, on the other side, and they have their own
Headquarters.
Headquarters. Yeah, yeah. They have their own site where they have historic buildings and the Phelps Tavern, and they have research as well there for local history.
So who would come to the Simsbury Free Library, you know, for the exclusive services you provide here versus over at the next door at the municipal library?
We have people here searching for their families. We have a lot of information about Simsbury families and local regional families that you can't get necessarily online yet or aren't available to the masses, so people can come here and get specific family histories. We also have computer access to the genealogy sites all over the country as well. Mm. And people come from all over, and they touch base here. It's really a wonderful opportunity to see people and learn more about the town as people learn more about their families.
And what kind of programs, you know, a couple that have stick out in your mind that you've either hosted or that you host annually that we could tell people about all over Connecticut they might want to come and visit?
We have a speaker actually coming on the 31st, Professor Tom Ratliff, and he will be talking about the King Philip War. Mm. He spoke in December about the Pearl Harbor. And we also have genealogy on the 25th. We'll be having Genealogy 101. People can come in, and we have our genealogist doing a preview or a little sampler of how to do genealogy and research.
Oh, so for folks who always thought they might want to do that research but never knew how to start, this is like a primer on how to get going on that?
Exactly.
Fantastic. Great. Well, this MLK thing is extremely exciting. Just when you think you know it all about a particular figure in history, how did this all get started?
We were trying to reach out to students and see if we could get some sort of a coordination of projects. And we've had a couple very successful projects. And this one was one of them that was spearheaded by Richard Curtis, who is the head of the history department in the Simsbury school system, and he got a group of students together to debunk the myth, as you previously mentioned, about Martin Luther King. And so the students came in, and they came in all summer. They did research, and they put together a documentary, which got critical acclaim and was well received by local and national bodies. And it was with that motivation that four of the students who were younger on the team, they decided that they wanted something more permanent, because as these students grow, they graduate, they move out of town, and so they wanted something more permanent that could have programming and basically be able to be available to other students coming along that could come and see in a memorial and know the history of Martin Luther King and his civil rights movement. So we worked on it, we got the documentary, and then the students it's been a very seriously studently led group where they have done the research, they've made presentations, they've fundraised, and they are still doing all of those things, and they designed the memorial, they did all the parts of it with adult advisors working with us and the staff here at the library. Mm. It's been a really exciting and wonderful project. Mm.
So as we sit here and chat, we're looking out onto Main Street or
Hot Meadow Street.
Where on the grounds are you planning to try to locate that?
As you stand on Hot Meadow Street and look at the building, it will be right in the front on the right hand.
Oh, okay.
On the right hand side, up towards the building.
Very good. Well, let's meet Brekina Grzeszewski. Brekina, did you have an interest in Martin Luther King Jr. Leading into this, or was it sort of the mystery and the study of this new development that kind of made you more deeply interested in the person?
Well, I've kind of been a history buff, like growing up and everything, and I actually didn't know anything at all about the MLK being here in Simsbury or the MLK and CT committee at all. It was actually my sisters who got involved in it when they were in high school, and through that, they kind of brought me into the group, and I mean, it was amazing because to learn that an iconic figure in history came here to Simsbury when he was young, when he was in school learning, and how that affected his life and his future is amazing. And
yeah, well, fill us in on some of the research that started this whole thing and brought us to where we are today.
So as you said before, debunking the myth whether Martin Luther King was actually in Simsbury or not, a group of 16 students, original 16 students, along with their teacher, previously mentioned Richard Curtis, kind of set out and what they discovered was that in the summers of 1944 and 1947, MLK worked on the tobacco fields here in Simsbury with other Morehouse College students where he was attending. And his time here was instrumental in shaping his future. What he experienced here was a more unified community, unlike the segregated South. And what really motivated the four out of the 16 students who had remained after the others had graduated was that to create a memorial, they wanted to honor him and have others to come and see this memorial and take away from it to be more educated and inspired towards self-correction and moral improvement in the world as well. And what they discovered and researched was that from Stanford University, they actually acquired a copy of his application to Crozier Ministry School, and which he states, and I quote, "My call to the ministry was quite different from most explanations I've heard. This decision came about in the summer of 1944 when I felt an inescapable urge to serve society. In short, I felt a sense of responsibility which I could not escape," end quote. And so and he states in the summer of 1944, which he specifically was in Simsbury working here. So for those students to discover that and read that, I mean, that's a powerful moment.
Yeah. And so now it was your sister was one of the 16 and they brought you on. How did that work?
No, actually my sister. So this has been going on since 2009. It's 2019. Yes. It's been 10 years. My sister was part of the crew about around 2014, I think. So she was part of the crew that really did a lot of the presentations and the fundraising. And then I had a younger sister who my oldest sister brought in, and she did a lot of the fundraising as well. And then I'm here now, and I feel like I'm finishing off their work and helping create more enrichment programs for this memorial and educational programs so that it continue on.
Well, I learned chatting with you a little bit before we went on mic that you're interested in pursuing a career in engineering, and also you have this kind of interest in history and, of course, this MLK development. You're going to be or are engaged in the design of the memorial?
No, I wasn't engaged in it. We are still working on it because it hasn't... We're breaking ground now, and the design of the memorial, the students and the adult staff that helped create the design for the memorial was amazing. I mean, each element has a significance to the message that we want to portray. There will be a series of 5 etched panels that will appear to be unsupported and kind of float, and so that the words of MLK's ideas are kind of not meant to be contained by walls, to be reflected so that other people can learn from it. And then each panel will illustrate his different aspects in life, his family history, his journey to Simsbury, what he got out from his time here in Simsbury and the importance of it, and then leaving Simsbury and returning back to Georgia and the segregated South, and then his subsequent legacy and civil rights and whatnot. And then there will be markers at the kind of entrance and exit of the memorial, which will be constructed out of brownstone, which is used in many of Simsbury's historic buildings, along with Georgia granite, which is where MLK is from.
Excellent. Folks, we're in the middle of this compelling story that as we're learning, brought Martin Luther King Jr. here to Simsbury, where he initiated his application Divinity School, to the ministry. We're going to come back and talk a little bit more about this very intriguing project. So stick with us. The story continues when we get back. We're with Tara Willerup, who's a vice chair of the Simsbury Free Library Board of Trustees and on the staff here at the Simsbury Free Library, and Brekina Grychewski, who's a Simsbury High School student and just the latest in a litany of students from Simsbury High School that have engaged in this project. Stick with us. We'll be right back. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click onto Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. This is Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. The Connecticut Office of the Arts is excited to launch its 2019 Arts Workforce Initiative Program. AWI provides internship opportunities for Connecticut college students, emerging creative professionals, and military veterans at Connecticut nonprofit arts and cultural organizations. The Commission of the Arts is currently accepting applications from organizations interested in serving as an AWI host. Selected host organizations will receive a grant from the Connecticut Office of the Arts in the amount of $3,750 and will pay for the intern at a rate of $15 per hour. Applications must be received by 9 a.m. on Monday, February 11th, however. So to learn more, call the Connecticut Office of the Arts at 860-500-2328. That's 860-500-2328. We are back, and thanks for sticking with us. If you were with us for the first segment, you heard the beginnings of this exciting story about the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and his experiences here in Simsbury, Connecticut, and how those experiences helped shape his future and personal and spiritual philosophies. The students of the Simsbury High School have been engaged in this project to build a permanent Martin Luther King Memorial on the grounds of the Simsbury Free Library for quite a long time. And we are visiting with Tara Willerup, who's vice chairman of the Simsbury Free Library's Board of Trustees, as well as one of the students engaged in the latest parts of this project, Brekina Grychewski. So we're going to go to Tara right now to talk about the bottom line, I guess, Tara, because these things don't come free and they don't really come cheap, but certainly creating something of a lasting legacy that students and folks can visit from all over the world and learn about and enjoy is going to take some support. Let's talk a little bit about how you plan on transforming this idea into this Georgia granite and brownstone that we were talking about before the break.
Well, we're very fortunate that we have had a architect, Jay Willerup, who has volunteered to translate the students' vision into actual building. He worked with the students and another, Peter McLean, who is a memorial designer and artist, and they to discuss how to make the elements memorable and do what they need and make a difference in creating a memorial that isn't just sticks and stones, but it actually has, every piece has a meaning. The students have been fabulous, and they have met our fundraising goals. We have moved the site, and so we do have a few more expenses than we had originally anticipated, of course. We are continuing to raise funds because we're not only, you know, building the memorial, but we're also creating educational enrichment programming. We're setting up an endowment for the maintenance of the structure for the years ahead. And there are sponsorship opportunities to have your support embedded in the memorial that are still available. And we also have an opportunity for people to purchase bricks, because part of the memorial is a pathway that, because the students really enjoyed the fact that Martin Luther King walked the same streets that they were walking. And so we incorporated a pathway that comes in from the north and moves to the south. And we have bricks that we already have about 300 people who have bought bricks to commemorate their ideas or family support. And anybody can find any of that information on mlkinconnecticut.org. It's not just a memorial. It's a place where people can sit, reflect, and learn about Dr. King, learn about the civil rights movement, take a really deep look at the history of America and where we were in 1944 and where we are today. And we want to make sure that everyone leaves here educated, engaged, and inspired towards self-correction.
Really an opportunity for anyone who's interested in taking advantage of the additional remaining opportunities to support this project. They're really contributing to like a living classroom.
That is our intent, of course, and we'll be working throughout with our building so we can we'll have a lot of and varied opportunities for education for all ages and all groups. And so we hope that we can really meet a need that we see in Connecticut. Mm.
And there's something about a designation on the Freedom Trail?
We are under consideration at the moment for a designation on the Freedom Trail. We don't really fit their actual specifications, but we are hoping that once we're built that we will be a place have a place there.
Great. The Martin Luther King Memorial that's being planned here at the Simsbury Free Library is not the only thing happening around the Martin Luther King situation. There's a big bunch of activities going on in and around the Martin Luther King Day of Observance coming up. So we're going to go with Brakina Grychewski, who's one of the Simsbury High School students continuing to work on this project, to invite you out, listeners, to a number of the activities that are going on here. Brakina, what's happening in the coming days and weeks around Martin Luther King Day?
Yeah, so on January 21st, the federal holiday marking Martin Luther King's mm-hmm. birthday, it'll be a ceremony to celebrate Dr. King's life and particularly the time he spent here. And it'll be held at the First Church of Christ here in Simsbury at 2 p.m. And the keynote speaker for this year will be Joel A. Murchison. And there will be readings from Dr. King's speeches and musical performances by the Henry James Memorial School Select Choir and the Simsbury Intonations Chorus. Mm-hmm. And along with that, the MLK and CT committee, which I'm a part of, along with other student members, will be having a presentation during the ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And a bake sale as well to raise more funds towards enrichment programming and educational programming for the future.
And there is no cost for folks to come out to this event? Free ceremony?
Yes, free. Please come out and join us. It'll be a very special ceremony.
Great. Before we find out how folks can support this, I wanted to ask you, as you're interacting with students, not just your peers at Simsbury High School, but as you're meeting folks who find out you're engaged in this, do you find that they're shocked to discover that Martin Luther King Jr. actually spent time and had these kind of revelations right here in Simsbury, right where you are right now?
Yeah, I mean, when I speak to my other classmates and, you know, I talk about being in this committee and what I'm doing for this committee, they're shocked, as you said. They're like, what? MLK has been here? What? And the fact that there still is a lot of information that we can find that we haven't discovered at all is amazing. Like, we can discover more about MLK and other important people who have done so much, and whether they were here in Connecticut, whether they have done in Connecticut. And so for me to experience all this, to have the opportunity to learn how to interact with not only other students, other communities, but other adults to raise money for this, is amazing. And
yeah, well, it's amazing for us to be able to share this story, and really inspiring, in the hope that folks who are listening might want to be part of it and support it. So, Tara, going to you for the final word of our visit this morning. Let folks know what they can do to learn more and to, as you said, we talked a little bit earlier about buying a brick. Just give the folks the details again if they'd like to learn more or become a part of or put their names to this project.
Well, we have two websites that they can absolutely reach at. One is mlkinct.org, mm-hmm. and then the other is simsburyfreelibrary.org. And both those sites will have information, and they're welcome to call the Simsbury Free Library if they would like to speak to anyone to get more personal information.
And the personalized bricks program, this has been ongoing. You already have a load of people who have invested.
We have about 300 people who have already bought bricks, and we will keep selling them because we have plenty of room for more in our brick pad, in our brick foundation.
Sure. And opportunities for corporations or individuals to either put their names to or memorialize a loved one, perhaps by underwriting a larger piece of this exciting project, which we heard about this morning from our guests, Brekina Grychewski from Simsbury High School, as well as Tara Willerup, Vice Chair of the Simsbury Free Library. Don't forget to come out to this absolutely free ceremony. You'll really get a lot more of the inside information on this exciting time when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was here in Simsbury about this project, and really get a feel for everything that is happening here as part of this project, coming out to the First Church of Christ at 2 p.m. on January 21st for this event. Plan to participate in that, or once again, visit mlkinct.org for more information. Thanks, guys, for having us here at the Simsbury Free Library.
Thank you very much for coming.
Well, as we said in our introduction, we're wrapping up the program, revisiting a program that has had such great reaction. As I was talking with our guest this morning, Leslie Darling from the Milford Health Department, several years ago when we had a program on around the graduation time for the Parent Leadership Training Institute, it apparently made such a great impression that the following session, people were calling up saying, "Yeah, we heard about it on the radio several months ago, and we wanted to get on board early." And in fact, this year, as I understand from Leslie, it was unclear whether or not the Parent Leadership Training Institute, the PLTI, was even going to happen because of questions as to where it was going to be funded. And in fact, sort of in the 11th hour, some funding came through, and the program has begun for this year. But the important thing is keeping the Parent Leadership Training Institute at top of mind as your legislators kind of go into this budget session through May. In the event the PLTI needs your advocacy as listeners, because this program benefits parents and students and communities all across Connecticut. But Leslie is the one who's primarily here to talk about it, not me. So let me hand the microphone over to Leslie Darling. She is with the Parent Leadership Training Institute. She's the coordinator for that program, as well as a case manager for the Milford Health Department. So, Leslie, I guess my first question is, how many different hubs for the Parent Leadership Training Institute are there across Connecticut?
Sure. Thank you, John. I believe that this year there were four programs that were funded across the state, which is down significantly from previous years. This is our ninth year running the program here in Milford, and I believe that at some point there were up to 10 communities that were running PLTI. So the funding definitely has been affected at the state level.
So this is a 9-week course, but let's reel it back to talk about what exactly the Parent Leadership Training Institute is. The imagination could run wild just hearing the name of it. Is it leadership in the home? Is it leadership in the schools? Leadership in the community? And in fact, it's really all of that.
Sure. So actually, it is a 20-week course.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. It's two separate 9-week sessions with a graduation and a retreat at the beginning and a graduation at the end.
Oh, okay.
So it's actually 18 classroom sessions, and it focuses on, the curriculum focuses on how to teach adults. They don't necessarily need to be parents. It could be any caring adult in the community. Mm-hmm. The leadership skills that they need to become effective change agents in the community and to be better advocates for children. So the program gives them the skills they need to go out into the community, to know the people, to talk to make change happen, how to get their voice heard, and helps them build the confidence to do all of that.
What are the curriculum points like? Give us an example of a couple of the things that that parents may go into the PLTI not knowing or being fully in touch with their inner talents to be able to actually accomplish what they set out to do with the BLTI?
Sure. So a big part of it is focuses on public speaking and finding your voice as a parent. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times parents go to, like, they'll go to a Board of Aldermen meeting or a Board of Education meeting, and they feel a little intimidated by the process. Mm. So we actually go to that as a group, to those meetings. We meet the people on the Board of Ed and the Board of Aldermen. We practice public speaking in class so that people feel more confident doing that, because I think that's a skill that everyone, has a little problem with and could use a little help building that confidence.
Yeah.
We talk about our state legislators. They actually come and speak to the class so that everybody learns who their representatives and their senator is. We meet with the mayor and the superintendent. So we talk about how laws are made, where parents have a place in that process, so that they're comfortable with knowing that they do have a role in all of that,
mm-hmm.
and are not intimidated by the process.
Now, I think one of the coolest things that has impressed me about the Parent Leadership Training Institute is that a lot of times parents may somewhat selfishly enter into the program, and rightfully so, believing that perhaps their young student will be the greatest beneficiary of the parent's participation in the PLTI. But what they don't realize is after these 18, 19, 20 sessions, that the initiative that a lot of the graduate parents take end up not only helping their own children and their own children's friends and neighbors, but many, many other students within that school district or that program that they may not even know.
Absolutely. We had a mom who joined the program because she had a child with some special needs, and she was interested in learning how to become a better advocate for her own child. And in the process, as part of her community project, she ended up writing a whole booklet that was sort of a parent's guide to the PPT process, so that other parents could pick this up very easily and read through it and see what the process was all about, so that they felt more empowered as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the last few minutes that we have with you, Leslie, as we said earlier in the segment, the 2019 sessions of the Parent Leadership Training Institute at the four locations that are happening in Connecticut this year are poised to or just in process. So it's too late to join for this year. But is there any information or quick advice that you can give to parents? Is there a majority of parents who come to the PLTI who have kind of more like a shared or uniform concern that you can speak to the greater listenership who may be tuning in who can't take PLTI, but there's a piece of advice you could give them that comes from PLTI that might be able to help them before they consider their application for 2020?
Sure. I think for any parent, any adult really in the community who's interested in what's happening with children and families, especially in the climate today, to try to get involved in whatever small way they feel comfortable, maybe joining the PTO at their schools, going to a Board of Aldermen meeting, making themselves familiar with their community, just to sort of dip their foot in and try it and see how they feel, what areas of interest they have, but to just get out there and do it. Because you meet other people, you make a great, some good contacts in the community and a support group for yourself as you move through maybe your children's education or whatever.
And it's interesting that you say that, and I do think that's good advice, because in my journalism world of covering local government from tiny little ad hoc committees all the way up to boards of selectmen and boards of education and such, being in the room as a fly on the wall is both interesting and helpful, because they have the processes and the lingo. There's language that's tied to a lot of what they do, and you get to know this, and it helps to melt away that that concern, or that you're being embarrassed about speaking out yourself.
Right, or the mystery of it.
Mm-hmm.
Once you make yourself familiar with it, it's not such an overwhelming task when it's something that you care passionately about and you want to go out there and make that change. You already are familiar with how the process works a little bit.
Great. And I guess the other important thing in saying farewell to you for now, Leslie, darling, is for folks that are listening, in the event that you engage with your local state representative or senator and you remember the program and you have an opportunity to say, hey, by the way, we hear about this program, the Parent Leadership Training Institute, and we understand that it used to accommodate many more parents than it does today. Please consider this program for funding or your support when you're out there. That type of advocacy cannot hurt at all. So we
Absolutely.
Hope folks will speak up on behalf of Parent Leadership Training Institutes all over Connecticut in the hopes that we can expand them in the coming years, since they do so well. And we are planning to come back and talk to some of the parents poised to graduate in a couple of months from the Parent Leadership Training Institute program here in Milford. So, Leslie, darling, we will be talking to you again post PLTI 2019, and we thank you for being part of the program this morning. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for airtime in writing to me via email at john.voket, that's john.voket, at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast without permission of Connoisseur Media. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scotts, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and important information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.